while many of us are willing to march and to protest and to become active in the face of police misconduct, I think too many of us turn a blind eye when it's us killing us.
That was Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake 6 weeks before the death of Freddie Gray, calling on African-American men to serve as mentors for younger men throughout the city. In the weeks since then, as turmoil and a surge of violence came to Baltimore, the phrase, "What about black-on-black crime?" has been used to counter those who angrily protested Gray's death in police custody, the suggestion being that protesters care more about one than the other. In this hour of midday, a conversation about the rhetoric of violent crime with American culture commentator Sherry Parks, coming up after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour of the show. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Midday on American Culture with Sherry Parks in this hour. Sherry joins us monthly with her observations about what she sees and hears. Today, a look at some of the rhetoric that has been heard in the weeks since the day of since the death of Freddie Gray in police custody, and the surge of violence following the unrest and this spring in Baltimore. Here's a quote for you. "For every unarmed black man, woman, or child killed by unrestrained police officers, there's an intellectually impoverished response when black people get visibly upset about it. What about black-on-black crime?" That's the opening line from a provocative essay by Charles D. Ellison for TheRoot.com, in which he argues against the use of the term and the suggestion that black Americans are more concerned with police brutality than with the everyday loss of life that occurs in city neighborhoods. Charles Ellison joins us today along with Sherry Parks. Sherry is Associate Dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park, and as I say, she joins us here once a month on Midday. Sherry, nice to have you with us again.
Nice to be here.
And Charles Ellison is a political strategist, commentator, and now contributing editor for TheRoot.com, also Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune. Nice to get you in the studio with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. It's a pleasure.
So you've been hearing this phrase actually for a long time, the both of you, black-on-black crime, but more so lately here in Baltimore, we've been hearing more and more of it since the protests in Ferguson, the protests over the death of Eric Garner, and then Freddie Gray, as a sort of counter to protests about police brutality and the death of someone in police custody who's African American. We frequently hear, "Where are the protesters when it comes to black on black crime?
Right.
Why aren't they out there doing that?"
Right.
So there's been a lot of that in the in the rhetoric recently. I guess that's what provokes you to write it.
Right. It's been in the rhetoric recently. I've been hearing it since I was a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, black on black crime. And, you know, you go to church on Sunday and you hear the preacher talk about black on black crime, about brothers killing brothers. And it's been an ongoing conversation for some time. It sort of lost some of its steam, I take it, you know, I guess when we started getting into the 2000s. But as of late now, it's been reviving itself. And there's an interesting sort of twist that's been happening in the political, on the political landscape right now in terms of the use of the word. And that is now fewer black folks are using the term black on black crime, or at least this millennial generation of, or generation, or black generation Y seems to be less comfortable with the term, as opposed to, you know, us in generation X. We seem to sort of reluctantly use it. A lot of our parents were using it. And now there's sort of this embrace by a lot of, primarily from what I'm seeing, white conservatives, and a lot of, that's where you're seeing the retort primarily from a lot of Republicans or white conservatives who are saying, well, what about black on black crime? And really, you know, I thought about that, and I've thought about that term over the years. And for a lot of reasons, it's just intellectually just misguiding. It's not really, it shouldn't have been really used in the first place, because when you talk about crime, when you talk about war, when you talk about the taking of human life, or when you're talking about one human committing some sort of act of violence against another human being, it's a lot of it's based on geography. It's based on proximity. It's based on socioeconomic conditions. And really, when we start talking about black on black crime, first, we're there's sort of this notion, this assumption that black people have this cultural or genetic predisposition towards crime or violent crime, and more specifically, violent crime against each other. So that's one. And two, it just the focus on black-on-black crime negates, or it just gets away from a very important discussion on that we need to have about these socioeconomic challenges, these ailments that are plaguing black communities. We need to have that conversation, not an intellectually, as I said, an intellectually bankrupt discussion on black-on-black crime per se. Because then if we're going to talk about black-on-black crime, and yes, I understand that crime in certain black communities. I grew up in North Philadelphia, so I mean, I've seen it. I know it. I grew up with that. And I know in certain black communities, crime is higher than in, say, white communities or even Asian communities. But there's crime in all communities, and it's happening based on proximity and
geography.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
So I was thinking about this today, Sherry, since you're the founder of this feast. If you wanted us to discuss this today, I'm glad you did, because I've heard it a lot lately. We don't hear about white-on-white crime. And somebody tweeted out this morning, that's because it's so disproportionate, because crime occurs among African-Americans at a greater rate than it does among whites. Now, I don't even know if that's true. Well, we don't use the term white-on-white crime.
And this is a very complex and nuanced conversation on a very sore topic, so I'm mm-hmm. glad that we're able to travel carefully over it. I mean, you and I have talked about what it means to say something is a crime, and it's based on crime statistics, who gets arrested for doing certain things. And it's very clear from the criminology research that a poor black male will get arrested for doing the same thing that a white affluent male will not get arrested for. So we have to be really careful about those disproportionate statistics. But one of the things I thought was interesting about what Charles just described is a conversation that's been going on among black people. It's wrong to say black people have not been demonstrating and talking about this for years. It's been an internal conversation because nobody else, frankly, cared whether black people were killing other black people. And what happens, and in a way it is a rhetorical conversation, and you framed it that way. What happens when a discussion leaves the black community and ends up on Main Street? It actually twists a little bit. And it's one thing to have internal critique, to say, we need to stop killing one another. Mm-hmm. It's another to hear it come out of the websites of the right as a type of counter-argument to police brutality. Mm-hmm. It's really a bait and switch, but what about? And I think that's where people are beginning to reject the term because of the way it's been twisted.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to an excerpt from Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake's possessive State of the City address. This is pre-Freddie Gray. This is in March when she made a call out to African-American men specifically to help address the problem of violence among young men, calling for them to serve as mentors.
Too many of us in the black community have become complacent about black-on-black crime. And while many of us are willing to march and to protest and to become active in the face of police misconduct, I think too many of us turn a blind eye when it's us killing us. And my goal is to raise the awareness and to raise the consciousness of people around this issue, because we have to demand more for our communities.
Okay, I want to step carefully over this too, Sherry. So what is the difference here? I had a thought I wanted to share with you and Charles and get your comments about it. The difference between the mayor, the African-American mayor of Baltimore saying this, and say someone on a white person on Fox TV sort of calling out black people for not protesting homicides, 43 homicides in the month of May in Baltimore, that this is an appeal to pride and to guilt. In the case of the mayor, an African-American mayor, her appeal is different than those who are critical, use it critically, who believe that they are pointing out a hypocrisy by mocking, say, Black Lives Matter, questioning why there are not more demonstrations in the street against homicides, which occur daily in cities across America. So mm-hmm. is there a difference here between the mayor saying it and those on the right, different motive?
Well, let's be clear. It's different for the mayor to say it in a black church and then to say it on the media. Those are two different statements. And I think what people are really upset about when it's used as a bait and switch from away from police brutality, the police should be held to a higher standard, frankly, than what we are coining as black on black crime. So those are different models, and that's why you get protests for one and not protests for the other. You do get demonstrations for black on black crime. I'm just going to use that term as a shorthand for now, if the audience will let me do that. When there is a black murder by another black person, there are funereal activities, there are displays, there are shrines that are put up, there are people saying this should stop happening. People, so it's just a different rhetorical space in which it happens. What I worry about when she said it, and I heard it when she said it, you know, before today, is turn a blind eye. And it didn't sit well with me. What blind eye is she talking about? Because I'm not seeing blind eyes.
Yeah, there's always this sort of assumption that black people don't care about the crime in their neighborhoods, that black people aren't concerned about stopping the disproportionate share of crime that impacts us in our neighborhoods, particularly in urban core neighborhoods like a Baltimore, like a Philadelphia, for example. Black people are very concerned about that. And like, for example, when you get into the broken windows debate, that conversation, it seems as though that conversation is happening absent a black voice or a black presence in it, as though, you know, and in fact, what you find, and I grew up in a neighborhood, grew up in a working middle class black neighborhood where we were extremely concerned about abandoned houses or about certain types of people or certain types of elements walking along that street. And keep, I remember my folks telling me, hey, you know, we need to clean up the trash because I lived in a row house on a street, urban corner in North Philadelphia. And we had to clean it up in the front there because we were worried about that broken windows effect. And so really,
are you saying broken windows, that initiative came from the outside in, and it was white people saying, you know, you can't live in a neighborhood like this, didn't know that?
Well, it just seems as though the broken windows debate, like, as though, because we typically, when we talk about it, we talk about cities like New York, for example, where Mayor Rudy Giuliani at the time, he was promoting that. He was promoting cleaning up the subways, cleaning up the streets, and this is a way that you combat crime. There are polls that actually show a significant number of African Americans actually support those types of policies. It's not even about broken windows. It's just about quality of life. Black people want a fairly decent quality of life too, just like everyone else does. And so when you she feels like she has a license to say, though, to use that type of rhetoric, because
she's
a black mayor, she's African American, so
she appealing
feels like
to
she
pride?
Can have that conversation.
Is she appealing to guilt?
She's appealing to both pride and guilt. I agree with you, but really what she should say is there is a complacency around how we address these conditions, the socioeconomic climate which leads to this type of crime. I mean, that's the problem with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, is just this lack of inspiration or this lack of encouragement for economic growth in Baltimore and trying to reverse the conditions that have been there for a long time. Everybody who drives through Baltimore, and especially where that unrest occurred in West Baltimore, that was a powder keg about to explode anyway. That was going to happen at some point. And so to just, you know, one, it's sort of her rhetorical compromise with the police lobby in Baltimore and in the state, let's keep it real, you know, where she's basically says, oh, you know what? Okay, I'll shift the conversation to black on black crime and take it off the socioeconomic conditions that led to this unrest and also police brutality.
This was pre-Freddie Gray, although she was addressing Ferguson and Eric Garner and issues about police brutality in Baltimore, pre-Freddie Gray.
I think we have to take into account what we're asking people to do. We're saying something is happening in your own neighborhood, and why are you not going to Main Street and protesting? What is really happening is that people are choosing to or not to have conversations with people in their own community. Some people are. Some people are doing some very brave work and talking to people and not saying they should stop it. They're saying you should stop it. And a lot of that work is interestingly done by women who are walking up and going and talking to people. I mean, they're doing that with violence. They're doing that with drugs. Some of them are being firebombed because of it. We've seen that in Baltimore. And those are often the results of direct conversations. And so I think it's a little misfitting to suggest that they should act in a public way for a private conversation, and a private conversation that is often occurring.
You agree with me that the mayor's motive is different than what we hear? It's used in a scolding way. The phrase black-on-black crime, or what about black-on-black crime, as you write in your essay, Charles, is used in a scolding way, or it's to point out a hypocrisy that you care only when the police, a white police force or a mixed police force, kills a black person. That's the only time we see you in the street.
Well, and that...
It's not true, but...
Well, right.
It's what what's said.
It is suggesting that somehow you're letting your own people slide and focusing way too much on the police, which is a slap. And one of the things that Charles mentioned that I think we really do need to emphasize is that one of the differences between previous generations and this one is that we have better, for lack of a better word, crime statistics. And we know that people tend to kill people who are around them. And so we have many phenomena. We have white-on-white crime and Asian-on-Asian crime.
Right.
But to pull out black-on-black to say it's a singular phenomenon is actually not true.
It's something we want to talk about in the next segment of the show, the point that Charles made in his essay about the way we live today, the way we've sorted ourselves out. This is more reflective of that than anything. This is the Midday Show, Midday on American Culture with Sherry Parks and our special guest today, Charles Ellison, joining us, contributing editor for TheRoot.com, who wrote an essay that you can find on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page if you want to read the whole thing and comment on it. We welcome you to this conversation. Do you use the phrase black-on-black crime? Do you think it was appropriate for the mayor to, in March, make this challenge to African-American men? And do you think it's a phrase that ought to be used at all? 410-662-8780 is our number, the Midday email address for questions, comments that way. Midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Dan Roderick's here with Sherry Parks for our monthly Midday on American Culture, joined today by Charles Ellison, contributing editor to TheRoot.com. In the weeks since the death of Freddie Gray, as turmoil and a surge of violence came to Baltimore, the phrase, "What about black-on-black crime?" has been used to counter those who angrily protested Freddie Gray's death in police custody, the suggestion being that protesters care more about one than the other. In this hour of Midday, a conversation about the rhetoric of violent crime with Sherry and with Charles Ellison. And when you were sort of explaining why this phrase, black-on-black crime, doesn't work, is inaccurate, actually, because crime is reflective of, incidents of crime are reflective of where we live, how we live. We live segregated lives. A majority black city would have majority black-on-black crime, presumably. So this is the point you were making about that. And backed up by some research that shows, this is how we live today. Even in cities that claim to be diverse have a lot of segregation still.
Right. Crime is based on living patterns. Crime is based on preference of residents. Crime is also based on extenuating socioeconomic circumstances that you can't get out of. So we live in communities where people who look like us are clustered. So, you know, we live in clustered black communities, clustered white communities, clustered Asian communities and Latino communities. And based on what we know about crime, and Dr. Park made a very good point about what's differing about the time we live in now is the data. So we have data points which show us that crime, for example, most perpetrators of crime are people we know, right? It's the dude that was crossing the street the other day. You saw him, and it just so happened, and then he knocks you upside the head, and it's like, oh, you know what? I did see that cat across. You know, it's based on where you live and the neighborhood you live in. It's based on proximity and geography, and it just so happens that, you have high rates of crime, yes, in black neighborhoods, but that's not because they're black. It's just because, you know, you also have these particular indicators, certain economic indicators. There's also a lot of black neighborhoods that are highly impoverished. There's a lot of high unemployment. There's a lot of high underemployment. We're not talking about the very high black male unemployment and underemployment rates that are still very much there. We're sort of fooling ourselves into this sort of notion that everything's okay, that we're recovering economically, because we're seeing the official unemployment rate drop, but amongst communities of color, it's actually still double digits. And particularly for black males, it's even worse.
And there are factors that contribute to violent crime. I mean, the prevalence of guns, first of all, is something that we need to make sure that we mention. But we know that the lack of jobs and poor educational systems contribute to a higher prevalence of violence. That's the CDC. I mean, when we're talking about data points, that says that. And so, not to take away from individual will, but individual will is contributed to by lots of other factors. And we know the things that contribute to crime. In your first hour, you were talking about the prevalence of alcohol contributes to crime. It contributes to violent crime.
I want to talk about blame for a minute, because you say it's wrong to blame black-on-black crime. You use that. All right. Blaming. Who's to blame for this? By talking about black-on-black crime this way, it's a way of blaming the black community for violence in the black community, right? Here's something I wanted to bring up with you that I meant to mention before when we were talking about this appeal to pride or to guilt that you might hear in the mayor's appeal in March. If a Jewish American, Italian American, or just a Jewish person, an Israeli person who lives in the United States, or an Italian person who lives in the United States, hears about a natural disaster in their homeland or their ancestral homeland, right? You respond because your people are in trouble, so to speak, right? There's an earthquake in Italy, so maybe an Italian American is more inclined to send money to a relief fund than someone else. I think we all respond in some way, don't we, to our ethnicity, to our roots, when there's a distress. In the mayor's case, because she was criticized by some people for joining in this black-on-black crime bit, I want to go back again to this appeal to pride, ethnicity, and guilt. And does any of that ring true with African-Americans when they hear this, when they hear such a statement, say, from the mayor? Or I guess maybe you don't hear it when it comes from a white person, but might hear it when it comes from another African-American person.
Right, right. And, you know, some of it's generational. So, one, it probably what she said resonates with an older demographic subset within the African-American community than that younger subset. So, and because, you know, once again, a lot of that language we saw emerge during the 80s and the 90s. Okay. And a lot of our, you know, like my parents, they use a black-on-black crime. And I don't think there's anything wrong with her tapping into ethnic pride and also some guilt, you know. But I think that it's the way that it was twisted, and it's sort of this political strategy that she's using because, you know, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, I mean, there's still an opening for her to run for Senate, to run statewide here in Maryland. She's going to use certain language to appeal to a certain base of voters in the state of Maryland. This is one of the reasons that Governor Larry Hogan won in 2014, appealing to white voters in the state who had concerns about crime or about certain populations here in Maryland.
Yeah, notice and
so I think the way she framed it.
Doesn't seem to have used it since Freddie Gray's.
Because she's realizing that there's a very politically active younger African-American voting base that she's going to have to tap into if she decides to run statewide here in the state of Maryland. I've done some reporting on that in theroot.com, where I've had sources tell me that that's still very much on the table. So she's going to be very clever and very crafty in her messaging.
One of the things that I have loved to watch in the wake of the uprisings and after Freddie Gray's death is a very intelligent, very politically astute conversation that is happening among young people, many of them African-American, but they have lots of allies, too. It's a very nuanced, intelligent conversation. And so the response to that type of rhetoric has been quick, and it has been very smart. And you cannot discount that anymore. Mm-hmm.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. If you'd like to comment with our guests, Charles Ellison joining me and Sherry Parks for this month's edition of Midday on American Culture. Let's see. Let's take a couple of calls. Folks have already called in. Jacqueline in Baltimore, we'll start with you. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
What did you want to say, Jacqueline?
I'd like to respond to your query about whether or not the mayor should have used the term black-on-black crime. And I think that in the context that I view it, I think it is appropriate and appropriate because there needs to be an onus placed on African Americans for the crimes committed against each other. In interpersonal violence, all data shows that there is disproportionality relative to black-on-black crime, regardless of the milieu, whether it is densely populated with African Americans or sparsely populated. And so it is appropriate. However, I do believe that the groundswell needs to occur for the citizenry to push the mayor and other politicians to be accountable for policies that can help to alleviate the stress that exists within the city of Baltimore and the vast unemployment that's associated with that. And if that occurs, then we could address the real problem that would not have a Freddie Gray or have the young girl, Mackenzie, who has died and no one has opened their mouth to say, I saw something. It's a cultural shift that has to take place, but there's onus and responsibility on both parties.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Sherry?
Well, it's interesting, and we had not touched on the point that Jacqueline pointed out, is that often underneath the black-on-black cry is this idea that violent crime is a personal problem, that if we just focus on the individual person who did it, then it will go away, as opposed to looking at the structural issues that we were beginning to talk about that lead to violent crime. Violent crime is another cry of despair. That you don't have any other way to say what you need to say. And we know that when people have other resources, when more affluent people have other resources, those of us who have seen corporate America or, you know, even higher ed academic political culture know that it can be just as ruthless as street crime. But you use different weapons. Mm-hmm. And so, and we don't really focus on that. And we don't focus on when people have no other way to say what they need to say, no other way to settle their differences, they resort to crime.
You know, I liked what Jacqueline had to say there, mm-hmm. and it made me think again about the opportunity that this turmoil has presented for the mayor, for all elected officials, not only in the city, but in the region, and the governor of Maryland. And I've said it, maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, mm-hmm. I'm being too idealistic here, mm-hmm. the idea of a suburban, urban, white, black, bipartisan, Republican, Democrat effort to finally address these problems, long festering problems in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. It could be a model to the rest of the country that struggles through all kinds of divisions all the time. Why not have it happen here? But the problem is, so far I don't see it happening. I see it as an opportunity that's slipping away. And I just wanted to add that. That's my little editorial comment, because I thought I want to keep putting in people's minds.
You know, something I want to sort of respond to something that Jacqueline said. It was a very insightful comment that she made. But it's just what makes – we have to really ask ourselves this question, and I asked this in the piece. Like, what makes black people so unique that we have, like, our own special black-on-black crime? Because, you know, and I kind of made the point in the piece where I'm saying, well – Russia has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. It's actually higher than the American rate, right? But you don't see Vladimir Putin going on TV saying, you know, we got to do something about this Russian on Russian crime, y'all. You know, we don't see that. And we also have other countries, particularly in places like Central America, South America, where you have people who are Spanish language people or people of Indian, of Mayan or Aztec descent or Latinos killing each other, very high crime rates, some of the highest in the world. But we're not talking about Latino on Latino crime. We're not saying that. But something makes black people very special and very unique that suddenly we get that name, that term. And I'm very curious about why.
When I was younger in North Carolina, there was a town that really had the highest murder rate in the country, and it was mostly white people killing white people,
right.
And it was never called white on white. But I'd like to
respond.
Or the
biker gang in Texas last week.
Right.
We didn't call that white on white crime.
I'd like to respond to your question about why blackness. And I think here we have to look at what is the work that blackness and marginalized black people are doing here. Because when you have a term that has that kind of currency, it's because it's doing some other type of work. Mm-hmm. And often with blackness, the way blackness works in American cultural discourse is it's a stand-in for other issues. Mm-hmm. It's a stand-in for poverty. It's a stand-in for crime. It's easier to take it out to what we perceive as the margins of society and discuss it over there with those people,
right.
When it's really a discussion that we need to have in the main structure. But that's too close and that's too dangerous. And so blackness actually does a job. I'm not saying it's a good job, a job that people want to have, but it's a it does a job for the main culture by creating this space where people can have these conversations and feel that they are somehow distant from them.
We're on Twitter at MiddayWYPR or Dan Roderick's in Baltimore Sandlots tweeting, "It's a fact, Jack. In the past 10 years, almost 70,000 blacks killed by other blacks. Huge red flag. And blacks are 13% of the population, too. Where are the good black people, leaders, NAACP board, question mark?" On that last part, you know, this has been answered several times, and we've had guests on our show here who have carried out demonstrations in our city. Munir Bihar of the 300 Men March, yes, getting ready again this weekend to form another a new group or add people to his group to go out to the, into the streets to spread this message, anti-violence message. The Reverend Willie Ray has been around Baltimore for years holding vigils in the street.
And Mothers in Charge in D.C.
Yeah,
have one this
another
weekend.
One. You know, so I guess the point is, as Justin George, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, says, just because you see it doesn't mean it's there. Isn't there because it is there. But here's Baltimore Sandlots pointing out the disproportionality again, throwing some numbers at us. And again, I asked that question, can you say off the top of your head how many whites killed whites? It doesn't seem to be a thing, right? Mm-hmm. But this is.
In Charles's article, he quotes the three top most violent states in the union.
Are actually majority white states. I mean, Nevada, Alaska, and also one of the other states is escaping my mind at the moment. But
most violent in per capita violence?
U.S. Or? In terms of per capita violence. So. Those are states, the top three. So you have the top 10 most violent states in the U.S., and the top three are actually majority white states. They're states where the African-American population is 2% at best. But we're not talking about that. We're not saying, especially a state like Alaska, where there's barely a 1% black population.
It's New Mexico.
New Mexico, that's it. Thank you. which is funny, I lived in New Mexico for a year and I forgot about that. But
Tamika, let's take another call, Charles. Mm-hmm, sure. Tamika for Charles Ellison and Sherry Parks here on Midday. Go right ahead, hi.
Yes, good afternoon to you and to your guests. I want to be clear. It seems almost as if there's a deflection. We're not saying that there's not crime going on in other communities, but we cannot ignore the fact that there is an issue with black-on-black crime. Not that it's not an issue in other communities. We have communities now that are in fear because of retaliation. We had a three-year-old who was killed 10 months ago, and somebody knows who committed that crime. They won't say it because they are afraid. So, you know, I keep hearing this, and I'm like, okay, we can't ignore that. Yes, there's social issues, there are economic issues, there are education issues, but we also have to look at ourselves and take an inward introspection of ourselves, like, what are we doing? You know, so I just feel like it's like deflecting from it, what the mayor said, what this person said. It is an issue, and it needs to be addressed.
Help me understand how it is different. I mean, if a white person is killed in Baltimore City, if there's a homicide of a white person, or in Baltimore County or somewhere, I don't think, what am I doing as a white person to help stop this again? I don't respond that way. Go ahead.
You hit the nail on the head that it is seen as collective responsibility, whereas for other populations, it's seen as an individual instance.
Well, yeah, back to your point.
And doesn't speak to the whole. And that's something that black people, we do to ourselves. You know, you see or hear about a crime story and you hope it's not a black person because of how it might reflect back on you. The larger culture is doing the same thing, and sometimes we absorb it. But I don't, Tamika, I think you're being a little tough on us. I think when we talk about the social aspects and the educational aspects, we are actually addressing the issue and not deflecting it at all. I mean, I think we cannot rest it with personal responsibility.
And real quick, I think the caller was, I appreciate what she said. The stakes are very high in the African-American community in ways that are not high in other communities. And so there is this fear that if we don't say black-on-black crime, that it's a less muscular approach to addressing those issues. But we also have to be very careful. It's like Dr. Parks here just said, you know, it reflects on us in a way that creates very, very negative and very impactful socioeconomic consequences in terms of how society overall perceives Black people. And then that leads to discrimination, that leads to economic problems, employment problems, et cetera. But we shouldn't feed into this notion that we're somehow genetically predisposed to that kind of to crime or to violence. While at the same time having a conversation that we really need to repair our communities and neighborhoods.
Charles Ellison and Sherry Parks here on Midday on American Culture. A short break. We'll come back and take some more calls. 410-662-8780. Also have an excerpt from Martin O'Malley's speech on Saturday in which he declared his candidacy for the presidency that I want to share with you and comment on. When he announced that he was running for president on Saturday, making it official, former Baltimore Mayor Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley made reference to the riots in Baltimore and tried to explain why riots erupted after Freddie Gray's funeral in April. I wanted you to listen to a little bit of this.
There is something to be offered to our country from those flames. For what took place here was not only about race, not only about policing in America, it was about everything it is supposed to mean to be an American. The scourge of hopelessness that happened to ignite here that evening transcends race. It transcends geography. Witness the record numbers of young white kids killing themselves on heroin in suburbs and small towns across our country.
Well, some non sequiturs there. But anyway, there's no question. I just wanted to say this in the context of what we're discussing today, black on black crime, white on white crime, which no one ever mentions. But Martin O'Malley certainly did mention white kids killing themselves in heroin after a sentence about the turmoil, the unrest that we experienced here in April following the death of Freddie Gray, the funeral of Freddie Gray. Anyway, there's no question that heroin abuse is a problem, and it's great that, you know, now it's now getting a lot of attention from elected officials, including the governor of Maryland. But, you know, heroin abuse has been a serious problem for 40 years more, maybe now, in inner city Baltimore, on top of a lot of other problems that we've discussed here that disproportionately affect Black citizens. High concentrations of poverty, high unemployment, economic segregation, isolation, whatever you want to call it, high rates of arrest and incarceration that occurred when Martin O'Malley was mayor. And I just wanted to note that here he is sort of deflecting. A caller used that word deflecting, and I think it was his way of deflecting attention away from the complaints of protesters over the death of Freddie Gray and others.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
Did you hear what I heard there?
I did sort of hear that. I heard O'Malley really trying to reach for a space where he can get as far away from Baltimore as he possibly can as he starts to campaign, as he starts to stump nationally. Whether he's stumping, if he really realistically thinks he's going to win the Democratic nomination, or whether he's stumping as vice president as well. And then that suddenly becomes a very problematic conversation once we get into we get closer to the Democratic convention in Philly, or once we get into the general election with Republicans as well.
What about this connection he made, or maybe it's not a connection, maybe it is a non sequitur, to go from talking about the hopelessness of inner city Baltimore to white kids using heroin in the suburbs?
Well, I mean, we are all Americans is the point he was trying to make. And he was planning to, I understand, run on his record in Baltimore. And before Freddie Gray, that would have been a different message. After Freddie Gray, that became problematic. But there wasn't a whole lot he could do to distance himself after having been mayor. And so I think he was trying to do what Obama would call a pivot
here. Yeah. Right, right. You know, what's really interesting is when we get into the 2016 general election, and we've been seeing unrest in places like Baltimore, for example, seeing certain cities where you've had these tragedies involving unarmed Black individuals, primarily Black men. They've been happening in cities that are Democratic, that are run by Democratic mayors. And it's not just about, you know, Baltimore was run by African-American mayors. But so, you know, it there's some commentary there that I think Republicans are going to exploit as far as Democratic mayors' management of urban cores or urban cities. I'm starting to see that messaging evolve. And I think that I think that O'Malley's trying to pivot away from that. I think that there's some worry within the Democratic Party about that, about Republicans taking advantage of that. So I see that there as well.
Let's take some more calls here. Kenneth, calling from Urbana. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is simply this. I feel like when I hear that term used on the conservative side, I feel like it's a way to marginalize. I feel like it's a way of saying that black people are other than, you know. If I took that logic out and followed it to its crazy conclusion, it sounds like this to me. If you people who are other than us, if you people would get your own house in order, then we'll think about helping you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just how it comes across to me.
Thank you very much, Kenneth. Dawn in Annapolis, your comments on this. Welcome.
Hi, Dan. You guys kind of touched on it. And I think Martin O'Malley bears a lot of responsibility. But don't Mr. Miller and Mr. Bush, who control the state legislature in Maryland, also bear some responsibility?
For which? What? What happened in Baltimore?
For the situation in Baltimore that leads to these conditions.
How would you make that argument, Don? So go ahead.
Well, no, but your guests were just saying that Mayor O'Malley was trying to pivot away and disclaim responsibility for the conditions in Baltimore that gave rise to these unrest. But don't Mr. Miller and Mr. Bush and the state legislature who control the legislature also bear responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could make that argument more indirectly than O'Malley, who was mayor for two terms and brought zero-tolerance policing to Baltimore City. And some people are saying that we're seeing the results of the alienation between police and citizens that took place during his administration.
Well, so, it was more of a conversation about that, about the zero-tolerance and borrowing the tactics from New York City to enforce that happened during the O'Malley administration as mayor, rather than education or mm-hmm. other
yeah.
issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd bring everybody in on this including the newspaper, all of us.
The caller makes a point. I mean, interestingly enough, the unrest happened shortly after a Maryland legislative session where there was a lot of discussion, a lot of debate about cuts in education funding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it cuts in more, even more specifically, cuts in education funding here in Baltimore City.
And there was direct lobbying by people, by right. black people from Baltimore
right.
during that session.
Exactly.
And by the mayor, to give to her credit, to change some of the laws that apply to police officers and discipline of police officers
mm-hmm.
That she,
mm-hmm.
she didn't get very far with. But anyway, to her credit. Tom in Fells Point, your comments on this. Welcome.
Yeah, Dan, I just want to point out that the whole context of the conversation has shifted. And Dr. Parks referred to that a bit ago, that, you know, originally we were having a conversation about cops killing people, and then all of a sudden somebody comes up, shifts the conversation to black-on-black crime. And so we end up talking about that, and the whole conversation has been about that. I think it's an important point, but there's no locus of responsibility. Who's responsible for black-on-black crime? There's no locus of responsibility, but there is a locus of responsibility for, you know, for cops killing people.
Okay.
And so I think the nebulous nature of the black-on-black crime is a lot harder to solve than what precipitated this original conversation.
Tom, I'll only say this to you. I mean, I sort of agree with your point, but we've had this extraordinary situation in the month of May. We've seen violence in Baltimore, shootings and killings on a level that we haven't seen since the early 1970s, on the heels of the unrest we saw in April, the demonstrations followed, not by the riots. When I say unrest, I mean the riots.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why this is sort of a 1-2 punch here, right? It's an extraordinary period that we've been through. In this spring in Baltimore.
Well, but to speak to his original point, what we were trying to do was to dig into this usage, this deflecting, and see what it was and what's underneath it. And so I hope you don't read us as trying to contribute to it, but we are trying to read it.
Oh, yeah, I don't think he sees that. But I'm just saying the reason that this phrase is being heard mm-hmm. more and more of is because of the circumstance that we've been in the last 6 weeks.
I think that's added to it. Yeah. I mean, we have to be careful because the national crime statistics have risen in the same period, as they often always do when the weather gets
warmer. Point that out,
would
you? We didn't cover mm-hmm. that. You, there's actually shootings are up over the across the country.
Yes, right. They are. Yes, they are, and they often do this time of year when things people are more in the street, they're more together, there's more room for conflict, and it happens. But other places in the country are seeing the same types of jumps as Baltimore. So I think we have to be careful about causality here, about saying that this is because of the unrest. It did happen after the unrest, and there may be a contributing factor about how the police are not responding to people, but other cities that don't have the same issues as Baltimore in the same way are seeing the same thing.
Ronald and Glen Burnie, will go to you next. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Go right ahead, Ronald.
Hi there.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to say that your discussion focuses on the effects of severe poverty, not the causes. If you go to Caracas, Venezuela, for instance, where the economy is really very bad, you're going to see rampant crime, murder rates, which are at the roof. The statistics are high. It's the same phenomenon. Whenever the stresses of a poor society begin to be intolerable, crime rises, and all of the dysfunctional aspects of living in such a place begin to rise. Drug addiction, promiscuity, drunkenness, et cetera, et cetera. Crime is merely one of the effects of poverty, severe poverty,
yes.
And that's what you have. Yeah. Black on black is really a racist term, in my opinion.
Thank you very much, Ronald. Can we go to another caller? We're short of time now. I just want to try to get another one in here. Larry in Towson. Go right ahead, Larry. Please be brief.
Charles raised the question, why the phrase black-on-black crime? And that phrase was invented, I think, to ease white fears. Don't worry about black crime because you're not going to be a victim of it. Mm. It's the blacks who are the victims of black criminals. Mm. And I think that's why that was raised, and now we have the unforeseen consequences of it being used to excuse stupid, terrible, horrible police work.
Thank you very much, Larry. I have an email to read, too. This is from Carol, who says, if we are all to work together on this in general, then isn't it fair to say that all of these conversations need to take place in the public sphere, as is evidenced by your show? She's countering your point, Sherry, about how this discussion needs to take place at a lower level.
I didn't say it needed
sure
to, that it had.
That it had is all yeah, always right. been. But anyway, that's right. I get it. Carol says, sometimes terms are not understood to be hurtful or critical, but rather to describe, however ineptly, a true concern for the people that are the recipients of that behavior. Only when we see the death of any human being as a crime against all of us can we work in concert to alleviate the pain and destruction that ensues. Well, I appreciate that comment. And we appreciate having Charles Ellison with us today, who's a contributing editor for The Root, Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune. And I've caught Charles on MSNBC Hardball Show with Chris Matthews.
Thank you.
It's nice to get you here today, and I appreciate your essay in TheRoot.com, which you can find on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. And Sherry Parks, also an author of a recent piece for The Root, too, right?
Yes.
Thanks for being here, Sherry.
Thanks for having me.
Sherry, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities.
Yes.
Associate Dean of Arts and Humanities. Oh, not in American Studies.
Well, I'm faculty in American Studies.
Okay, I get that straight. You think after 3-4 years now I get this straight. Anyway, Sherry Parks joins us once a month for Midday on American Culture, which you've been listening to. We appreciate your tuning in today. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
And Charles, again, thanks for coming up and being with us on the show.
Thank you, Dan. It was a pleasure. Appreciate it.
We'll be back for another edition of Midday Friday tomorrow, a review of the news of the week. And it includes a film review by Chris Reed, some book recommendations from Paula Gallagher, and some tips on barbecuing from a couple of master grillers who will be with us tomorrow for the second hour of our show. So I'll see you then at noon tomorrow on the Friday show.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Aaliyah Satterfield, Kaylee Sadek, and Campbell Reed. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.